I happened to think of, while I was trying to think about our class today, Miss Hallie Mitchell. How many of you in the room here were, I knew Miss Hallie, John, you got, you, several of you guys did. Miss Hallie was from up in Polk County originally, and then went to Washington, D.C., and worked for her whole career there, and then they moved back to Springfield when she had retired, and Miss Hallie worked for the United States Treasury Department for many, many years, and she was her job was in the Department of Questionable Documents, which meant basically that she was a person who checked counterfeiting problems. And I asked her one time, how did you go about that process? And she, did you have to, every time somebody came up with a new idea about how to do stuff like that, did you have to get educated about that? And she said, no, that's not how we did it. What they did is to train us to recognize the real thing. Once you knew all of the characteristics, all the various marks on bills and so forth that were the real thing, then how it felt, and I mean everything about it, you'd recognize the counterfeit from that. And I thought that that's very much the approach that John takes in the letter of 1 John. There are, you'll see today, and we begin more of his delving into this, there are counterfeiters at work in the with regard to the faith of Christ, and John wants to deal with the counterfeiters without undermining the confidence of his brothers and sisters. And if you think about what we're saying here, you can see just in the background so far what I'm getting at. He's laid down the foundation here. You can't say that you have fellowship with God while you're in darkness. God has done everything that's necessary to make it possible for us to walk in the light instead, up to and including providing propitiation through the blood of His Son for our sins, an advocate at His right hand in heaven, a cleansing that goes on all the time. And you remember we studied through that part of this already. Now, then He starts, all right, here's how you recognize the real thing. People who are walking in the light make it their habit to, morally speaking, to keep the commandments of the Lord and to walk as Christ the Lord walked, to live that way, morally speaking. That's the way of life. And then, relationship speaking, or socially speaking, their habit is to love their brothers. Now, I'm wondering, do you spot, just up to this point, a possible flaw in the approach? I know that's not a clear question, but I want you to think about it for a minute. And then I'll ask it this way. Don't raise your hands and volunteer, but to yourself, see if you recognize this. You are, how many times would a sincere, genuine-hearted person hear these first two tests, keep the Lord's commandments and imitate the example of Christ, and then love your brothers like you should, as Christ loved us? And you hear that and you say, I wonder if I've loved like I should. I wonder if I've done enough, if I've obeyed enough, if I've kept the commandments well enough. That's what happens here. And so John, remember last time, in verses 12 through 14, he takes the different children, fathers, young men, and he says to them, your sins are forgiven, you know him, you overcome the evil one, you are strong, the word of God abides in you. So he reassures like that. Now, and then he continues his discussion about love in the Christian life. Go back to verse 5. What does he tell us about who are we to love according to verse 5? Or what are we to love? All right, we're to love God. So if I can say this. Now move down here to... So this is first, and then we're in verse 9. Come down to there. Who do we love here? All right, your brothers. All right, and then come down to verse 17, where we are now. And what do we find out? Verse 15.
That's what not to love.
All right, we're told to love God. We're told to love our brothers, but not the world. All right, so there becomes the sort of the challenge, or one of the challenges that John gets at here. And if you think about this, there's an answer to what he's getting at in the way these three things balance out. And if you love God, then you keep his commandments. That will define what it means to love our brothers, to treat them like the word of the Lord tells us to treat them, to not do to them what the Lord's Word tells us not to do to them. And these two loves will define what is meant by this prohibition or this negative. We'll learn what he means by not loving the world by looking at those two things there, having them in the background. All right, now verses 15 through 17, I'd like you to count how many times in your mind he refers to the world in this little paragraph here. Brendan, you always volunteer up here, I noticed, to read. If you'd read that for us. 15 through 17.
Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lust. But the one who does the will of God lives forever.
All right, now, how many times did he mention the world there?
Six.
In three verses, you kind of get one of the ways John teaches is by repeating a word. So all of you who ever think the preacher repeats himself, please take notice of the strategy there in this. And then flip over to chapter 4 and verse 10 for a minute and look at something. We read it this with regard to the propitiation. What does it say? Let me get the right verse. He uses the word world, if I can find it. All right. Verse 9.
What chapter?
4. Look at what he says. In this, the love of God was manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world, so that we might live through him. And this is love, not that we love God, but he loved us. And us having been in the world where he sent his son to redeem us from. Can you spot any question that might come up there? This is in John's other writings too. I think you might recognize it most in John, in the Gospel of John in chapter 3 and verse 16. Anybody remember what that says? For God so loved, what was that?
The world.
All right. So, does that raise a question in your mind at all? Did God do something that he's telling us not to do?
Intend to meet his creation instead of...
All right. So there are two possible... there is an apparent contradiction, and there are two possible solutions to it. First, either the two passages are ones in which the word world may mean different things, or in the two passages... love may be used in different senses, or both. So think about the meaning of the word world and what Eddie just said. John uses this term in at least three different ways, maybe more. One of them, like the created world, what we call the natural world. The cosmos, the universe, what God has created in that way. And that's one sense in which the world is used. Another sense in which the world is used is the people in it. Those made in God's image, persons, humanity, God loved that. And the third way in which God, in which this word term, this term is used in the writings of John, especially in the rest of the New Testament too, and some of Paul's writings, is in the sense that this is, here's one definition I've read that sticks in my mind. Human society as it organizes itself without and against God. That would be the world. In that way, who is the God of the world, of this world?
Satan.
All right. It would be the realm then that John has already referred to as darkness. If you see what I'm getting at, the sense in which the world is used here is the same sense in which darkness is used back in chapter 1, in my opinion. I think that's the way to understand it. Yes.
Well, I think of it as we're not to love worldliness.
All right. So think about worldliness, which would mean the way of life, the characteristics that belong in the realm which is organized, moral, spiritual realm, which is organized without and against God, or which is ruled over by the evil one. And you also mentioned the word love worldliness. There's two different senses possibly in which love can be used. Some of the older commentators have really pointed this out, and it's a thought-provoking thing. They'll say that there is, on the one hand, what chapter 4 talks about, which is the love of redemption. The love of the world which seeks to redeem it from its being dominated by darkness or by the devil and his ways. And on the other hand, there is the love of participation, in which one wants to belong in that moral spiritual realm and to participate in it and be a part of it. So if you think about it then, you get an idea of the way in which the balance is struck here. To love God, one would have to love the things that are like God. But the realm which is against God, that would mean you what you what you love, the character you love, then you'll also hate what is opposite of that. Does that make sense to you? And the Bible often uses that kind of metaphor. Now, with loving our brothers, you seek what is best for them. You love and want what is in their best interest. Therefore, you hate what is not, what ruins them, what would shipwreck them, what would be destructive to them. And so, one could not truly love God and his brothers and still love a way of life, thinking, or believing which is opposed to God and destructive to brothers. Okay. Now, in the passage that Brendan read for us, we'll go back and look at it for a moment. There are two big arguments that he makes about why we don't love the world. And the first one is in verse 15. What is it? If you love the world, all right, the love of the Father is not in you. If you love the world. So you think about what he's getting at. If you love this, then the love of him can't be in you. And he defines it for us, what he means by that, in verse 16. What? For everything that's in the world is what? First, lust of what? Lust of the flesh. First, what is lust?
Follow after.
All right, it is.
Just to desire.
All right, it's the controlling desire for something, such a desire for something which takes control of the person and dominates the person's thinking, action, and thought, and words. So lust would be, if I could refer to it this way, misplaced desire or evil desire or desire for that which one has no right to. This lust is dominated by the flesh. Now, remember that in the Bible, especially with Paul's writings and I think with John's too, the flesh does not simply mean the physical. Like if I have a desire for lunch, which I will have pretty soon, that does not mean that lunch is evil or that hunger is lust. If, however, I close my book right now and say, you know, my breakfast bar that I had this morning is fading out on me. I'll see you guys later. I can't wait. Then you see, that's a simple illustration. But the flesh is maybe thought of as the lower nature or the desire untethered to godliness or to God's. Or to God's nature, or to God's family, or to God's will. So that's one. What's the second thing that he says that's in the world?
Lust of the eyes.
Lust of the eyes. All right, so we've talked about lust for a moment. So same thing now, not with the physical desires, such as appetites, sexuality, those types of things, but now the lust of the eyes. What would that be?
That big house they live in.
All right,
it would be the
illicit or evil desire for that which can be seen. We would think of it as materialism, but also we would think of it as the love of appearances or preoccupation so much so with how we look that we can't value personhood, or we can't see things the way God does. And then what's the third thing?
Pride of life.
Pride of life. What might that be? The pride of life.
Possessions.
All right. Sometimes it's even translated pride of possessions. I think the idea, though, that I see in it is the thought that I'm alive, I look good, I do what I want to do, therefore I'm permanent. And I don't need God telling me what to do, and I don't need to have an obligation to my brothers. The pride of life is so you have much goods laid up for many years, therefore do what?
Eat, drink,
and be merry. That's only, of course, that's only an ancient philosophy. No relevance today. But you see what we're getting at. Now, can you think of any times in the Bible where these three things appear in an event that might cause us to actually be able to visualize what we're talking about?
In the garden.
All right, in the garden, when she saw, with the suggestion of the tempter, of course, that this was good to look at and good to eat and would make you wise like God. All right, can you think of any other occasions when these three things appear?
David.
All right, with David. David would be one of them. The king's pride of life. Then he sees the beautiful woman, and then he desires to have her brought to him. Then he doesn't want to be found out, and then he tries to make it appear that Uriah just died, so that he could have what he wanted. Can you think of any other occasions?
Jesus' disciples actually put his right hand. They didn't understand his kingdom.
All right. James and John, when they are asking to be at his right hand and his left hand when he comes in his kingdom, that idea would be one. Nobody mentioned Jesus and his temptations. What were they?
Yeah.
All right, they were suggestions for that. Turn these stones into bread because you're hungry right now. I'll show you all the kingdoms of the earth. Throw yourself down and worship me. Well, that idea. I mean, if you cast yourself off, and God will send an angel and catch you up and all that. So those are always the essential marks of what John means by worldliness. And by the world here. And why he means that we should not, his little children, as he refers to them here, should not involve themselves in love for these things, because these things are not from the Father, but from the world. Now, what's the other reason why the world is not to be loved, admired, or desired? Verse 17. All right. The other thing is, the world is passing away. And to John, this seems to be so self-evident that he doesn't even try to argue it. What would be the evidences that these three things pass away? Think about it for a moment. The things the flesh desires, I read somewhere this past week, by the way, you can tell what really can can satisfy a man in life this way. You take a man who has six kids and a man who has $6 million and ask which one wants more. Which can satisfy? Relationship, family, or this, this, and this? It makes me grin when I think about that. That's a simple illustration. So the flesh, once gratified, wants more. The eyes get what they see and then want what joins it. And then before very long, they can't see anything. And then the pride of life. One of the national news magazines used to have in it the up and this week, the up and this one's down. And I would read that thing and I would notice that the person who was really, really ascending one week would be, he would be, the arrow would be pointing the other way the next week. And that's a terrible thing. Now, involved in this, there is an amazing statement if you think about it. But what?
Whoever does the will of God.
Whoever does the will of God abides forever. Why? Because God does. You become of Him, you see. And there is a way of life which is passing away. There is a way of life which lasts. So, all right, any observation or comment, question on this little paragraph here? It's really an important little paragraph. We've used it a lot of times mostly to preach against things. That's probably unfortunate. It really is an argument for doing the will of God, the lasting value of doing the will of God, which involves keeping His commandments, loving your brothers. Okay, Aaron?
A bit reminiscent of Ecclesiastes 12:13.
Yes, yeah, go ahead.
The end of the matter, all that's been heard, fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man.
All right. And in Ecclesiastes, that statement has special meaning because it's a case where a man talks about it from the perspective of experience. He talks about all he had this all this position. He said, and he'll say, I tried to get things. I got more than anybody ever before me. And I tried to build things, and then I tried to know things, and I tried to experience things, to eat, drink, and be merry. And what I found out is what? All is vanity, meaning that it all produced emptiness. But whoever would fear God and keep His commandments would find out that that was what life is all about. That's sort of the way it's said. All right, anybody else? Thank you, Aaron. Anybody else? All right, now, what happens then is that's the way John sums up his first round of admonition about loving. And it stands out, again, that he has in mind something more than simply a warm feeling about things. Loving involves the priority of doing the will of God in the setting of relationship among brothers and with the intention to follow Jesus. Now, beginning at verse 18, the third test begins. And this time, we've already had the moral question of whether I'm doing what God says and following the example of Jesus. Then the relational or the social question, which is whether I'm loving my brothers. And now we get to, I suppose, what you could call the faith test or the doctrinal question, which is whether I recognize that Jesus Christ has come into the world in the flesh. And I've noticed that there's some hesitation to take up this thought here, because there are some people who believe, wait a minute, if you take this literally, you'll be saying that none of the other doctrines matter. But the way John looks at it is, you settle one great thing first. Has the Son of God come in the flesh? If he has, a whole bunch of other stuff is already settled. What's the authority? Who's the authority? What work that he has done really matters? What does he want his people to do? All of those things spring from whether he was the Son of God in the flesh. And I will mention again that if you go back to an illustration we use in starting this series, what Luke told us about the state of those who identify as Christian now, very, very little mention is ever made of the fact that the Son of God actually came in the flesh in a historical setting, and he lived and died and was raised up again. There's very little emphasis on that. So we may not use all the same terms, but John is battling a particular variety of the same sort of religious approach that we have in contemporary culture facing us right now. And it's ignoring the historical act of God in sending his Son in the flesh, and not attaching our faith to that. In the process, John uses a term that is striking because of what the evangelical world thinks about this. Antichrist. How many of you have heard that? By the way, have you heard right now that about the biblical numerologist who has determined that biblical prophecy declares that the end will come a week from tomorrow? Well, be forewarned. You guys now, it was April 23rd, wasn't it? I think 23rd is what it is now. It does. It is a movable target. I noticed there's fascination, that kind of thing. So notice what John says. We'll just do this two verses at a time since our time's running out here. 18, John 18 and 19.
Children, it is written in the hour, and as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, so now many Antichrists have come. Therefore, we know that it is the last hour. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out that it might become plain that they are all not of us.
All right. Now, I really urge us to try to keep this in its setting with the problem that John is dealing with here in this section. First off, there is no article in the original with last hour. It is last hour. That's the idea. This is the time in which John's readers are, the age in which his readers were living. It's the age in which we're living now. It's like saying, we sometimes refer to the patriarchal and mosaical and the Christian age. And in New Testament terms, the Christian age is the last hour. It is the last time. It is the age to come and that idea of it. It is this time, John says, not that it's coming, it is. It's the nature of the time. And then he says, you've heard what? That antichrists are coming. This apparently is something that was taught by the apostles. And it's something, if you read Paul's writing in 2 Timothy 3 about this, the hour is coming type thing. And then if you notice in 2 Thessalonians 2, I think it's at verse 5, it talks about the man of sin or the man of lawlessness who is coming. A lot of people are fascinated with what person, what individual that is. And you'll find all kinds of names attached to it. I've heard some various religious leaders, or various political leaders, or various other individuals. What does this term actually mean?
Against Christ.
Against Christ. The anti, you know, anti means opposite, or against, or that idea. Christ, an adversary, an opponent of Christ. Now, what important thing does John say in this word here? I'll give you a hint what I'm getting at.
He's saying they're already here.
All right. When you say antichrists, then you notice that we're dealing with a spirit or an attitude or a teaching that is embodied in more than one individual. Jesus taught in passages like Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, that false Christs would appear and people would see them. These are opponents of Christ. Now, the other thing he says, now many antichrists, what? Have come. So, there were, by the way, this term, antichrist, is used, what, five times in the New Testament, always by John, four of the times maybe in this letter here, and once in 2 John. And it's so interesting that while contemporary thought argues over who that is and when he's coming and all that, John's, when he brought up the word, he said, have come. And I can't help but think of this, where the world that we've just read about exists, it is, I see people, nobody, you guys got to tell me if the bell rings. Where the world exists, there have to be antichrists, right? They have to be involved. I'll have to turn, you're already late picking up your kids, so I'm sorry about that. You guys, thanks for being with us today. I hope everybody has a good week, and here's hoping for spring weather. Until next Sunday.